Mozam, welcome to Active Voice Radio on KSFR in Santa Fe.
Good to be with you.
I was really struck reading your book this week, first about your upbringing there in the UK, but it was such a unique upbringing with so much around it. Tell us a little bit about how you were brought up in the UK and how your family schooled you.
My father was originally from India, and he was one of these people who believed in sort of a liberal education, so he sent me and my brother to initially a Jewish school for the sort of primary school years for me were in a Jewish school. And later in a Christian school. I think he had a very broad idea of what it was to understand and appreciate different cultures from all across the board. And although he instilled in us Islamic values, he certainly didn't exclude the other values of different peoples that lived around us.
And it was from some of your early schoolmates that I first read about you in the media. I found it very impressive that later in life they remembered so much detail about your schooling and took such a stance with you.
Yes, I mean, certainly, I think there were two in particular that wrote about me when I was in incarceration, one of whom I remembered, one of whom I didn't, but certainly I think for me the early years at the Jewish primary school that I was at helped to formulate my ideas of the rest of the world, and I think they're some of the most memorable, nostalgic days of my early youth.
And now, what brought you to Afghanistan? What brought you to Afghanistan originally?
My first visit was, I think, it was actually just a sort of a consequence of a general visit to Pakistan, in which it was more of curiosity than anything else. But when I came to Afghanistan in 2001, that was already part of a process that I'd begun, which was to build schools for girls in Kabul and to build wells in the drought-stricken regions of the northwest. That was also part of the sort of search for identity, as in where I felt that I was needed most, where I felt that I could do a little bit of work that was socially beneficial to people, and at the same time also have to help to discover or rediscover some of my own identity, which was part of a process that I was going through in my 20s.
Now, you talk about some of your early experiences, and it's rare for us to get an insight. Tell us about your impressions of the Taliban before the U.S. came to Afghanistan.
Well, I didn't live there very long, but for the few months that I was there during the time that the Taliban were in control, I was apprehensive in the sense that the harshness of the rules, despite being a practicing Muslim, coming from Britain, I was apprehensive that the rules might be too harsh, in that I wouldn't be able to go out with my wife, or my wife wouldn't be able to go out shopping and things like that. But I found that all of the hyperbole that was abounded around the Taliban wasn't necessarily my experience. So that my wife could go to the shops and to the markets and buy things quite freely. There was women's education there, which was one of the prime things that really attracted me and her to spending some time in that place. Although they wouldn't afford this right to a lot of the non-Muslim non-government organizations who existed there. And I think one of the reasons was that they, for whatever reason, felt that they were bringing in non-Islamic agendas. So I think that they were a little more perceptive. However, I did see some brutality administered by the Taliban during the time I was there. I had some personal experience of one of the members smashing into my car and then later denying all knowledge and those sorts of things. I saw a couple of aftermaths of some executions. When I was driving past, I saw four people hanging off the ends of trucks. But I think that, you know, that for the little knowledge that I had, to understand the Taliban, you need to look during, before, and after to really make a sort of a full picture. And I understand that before the Taliban were in power, the various warlords were fighting one another, vying for control, and had destroyed the country more than the Soviets had. So in that sense, I suppose the Taliban brought out about a bit of security, and they had a popular support in the beginning. However, their harsh application of their interpretation of Islam is what ultimately alienated them from the people. And also their position with Al-Qaeda.
Let's talk about your initial abduction from Islamabad. You were taken from your home. And I was, in reading this section, I was struck by the differences that you make between the local Pakistan police officers who were involved in this, and then there were U.S. people involved, and you said that they were wearing these almost ridiculous disguises. Tell us about that abduction a little bit.
Yeah, well, it was probably the most unforgettable night for me and my family in all our lives. And that is the night of the 31st of January 2002 at midnight, precisely. There was a knock on the door. I answered the door to be faced by several people, some of them wielding guns, others wielding tasers or electric stun guns, pushing me to the ground, putting shackling my hands behind my back and shackling my legs. And then just before the hood was placed over my head, the last vision I had of them was them walking towards my children's room and me saying to them not to go in there. That's the last I saw of my family for the next 3 years. I was then taken physically into the back of this vehicle, and somebody lifted my hood, and I saw this, as you say, sort of ridiculously looking Caucasian, obviously American from his voice, person who took a photograph, and then another one produced a pair of handcuffs, saying that that he'd obtained these handcuffs from one of the wives of the victims of the September 11th attacks in order that he could catch the culprits. And I remember feeling and saying that it was absolutely ludicrous, but it was the beginning of a nightmarish, Kafka-esque, absurd journey, which ended only at the beginning of last year.
And in all of this, you managed to, with a dying battery on your cell phone, contact your father in England. If not for that, how would they have ever found out? When did your family actually find out what had really happened to you?
Well, I mean, you know, that's one of the strange things about all of this, is that had I not been able to make this phone call, and of course I maintain that these people who took me, in fact, did kidnap me, because had they been the police, they would have charged me, given me an arrest sheet, and they would have searched me. But they didn't. So I made this phone call from the cell phone that was in my pocket to my father and told him that I'd been kidnapped, Americans were present. I don't know what I'm supposed to have done, but I was frightened. I don't know what became of my family, my wife and my children, and I had no idea what became of them for the next almost 7 months. And I would have assumed that my wife would have somehow, or hoped, I was praying that she'd somehow managed to get in contact with somebody, some family members in Pakistan, and then probably go back home to the United Kingdom and to liaise with my father. But unbeknownst to me during all of this time, in fact, what my father had done is initiated a habeas corpus case challenge with the Pakistani government, and the Pakistani judge had ordered all government departments to immediately send me to the court, and they all denied knowledge. So this was sort of a classic cover-up job.
I was also really struck with this overwhelming tone of racism that exists in the UK that we rarely hear about, that really is much along the lines of what African Americans experience, which is this equality until you're faced with authority, and then authority puts you down a level. Is that something you were accustomed to or shocked to find out in these situations?
It's one of these things that sort of, you know, you scratch the surface a little bit and you find that it rears its ugly head. You pray that it's not like that, that things have moved along now. And because you're British and you can relate to the same things and that you can, you know, you have a common sense of being in one sense. That just seemed to be completely shattered for me when the British came along and completely had sort of a plausible deniability. They denied having any knowledge of me or any access, given any access to me by the United States, even in letters that I've seen to this day that were sent to my father. The only official meetings that they ever had with me were in Guantanamo, where an official government representative came. So any thoughts or hopes that I'd had of getting any justice, any sort of consular favor from the United Kingdom was all shattered. And that's probably one of the hardest things for me to be able to deal with since my return.
So your father tried to fight the good legal fight and go through the legal procedure immediately, but you were already on your way to Guantanamo Bay at this point, and you went through Kandahar. Tell us about what that experience was like.
Well, immediately when I was handed over from Pakistani custody to the United States custody, I'd always felt that it would be the opposite, the treatment would have been the opposite way around, that the Pakistanis would administer the abuse and the Americans would be much more level-handed. But it was the opposite. The Pakistanis were very apologetic. They treated me very well. They didn't put me into a cell. They put me into a room. When I was in American custody, almost from the outset, it was being stripped, not only just stripped forcibly, but with several soldiers sitting atop of me, taking a knife to my clothes, me feeling the steel against the cold, cold steel against their skin, being sliced off, then being shouted at, spat at, kicked, punched, dogs barking, being shaved, being loused, de-loused, as they call it, having photographs taken by many soldiers at the same time, being hooded and shackled, thrown inside a disused barn, and generally, I mean, being treated like an animal in the true sense, I mean, worse than an animal. You wouldn't treat an animal that way.
This is all recognized now as torture, and we talk about these techniques as torture now. Did you experience it as torture at the time, or because they were doing it to everyone around you, did it seem common?
Well, yeah, of course it seemed common. And watching and hearing the screams of other people, it seemed very, very common. I mean, just the simple fact of moving one person from a cell or a detainment cell to interrogation was a huge drawn-out process, complicated in the sense that several soldiers were involved. The detainee had to lie in the prone position, had guns pointed at him continuously, and then was bent over double in an excruciatingly painful position with the arms raised above from behind the back in what they call almost a reverse strappado position, which is actually a torture technique in itself. And being moved in this way, sometimes actually suspended in the air with your hands behind your back up in the air, that was a method that was being used in order to cause... And ironically, it was definitely a tactic of terror. It is designed to terrify you into becoming pliable in order that you will answer all and any questions that are put to you and more. So I think that this was certainly in the outset, it would be defined as torture, as cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment.
And early on, there's an experience that shows that the interrogators aren't really looking for real information. They're just looking to break the people that they're interrogating.
Certainly in my experience, I mean, you know, they did put to me, what plots do you know about? Who do you know is going to attack somebody? When was the last time you saw Bin Laden? When was the last time you saw Mullah Omar? These type of questions were almost standard to everybody. To me, it was clear that it was a fishing trip, at least in my case. Perhaps they might have had others who they suspected were really involved in acts of terrorism or so forth. But in my experience, and in the experience, I think, of the majority of the people that are held there, they didn't know what the hell they were supposed to have done to the United States or to anybody else. That was the biggest problem, just not knowing what it is that you stand accused of.
And yet you must have stood out, being from Britain, being so articulate, you know, going over to Afghanistan to start schools and having a wide range of cultural and intellectual knowledge. Didn't anyone just turn around at some point and say, this guy just doesn't belong here?
Of course, yes. And I think that, you know, the more that I tried to explain to these people, the worse it was. And we are living in a global world. It's not too uncommon to find people from all over the world. I mean, you get Britons living in the Amazon jungle, and Americans living in, you know, in Timbuktu. I mean, that's the sort of world we're living in. So to find articulate British guys or whatever in Afghanistan is not an issue. It's not a reason to keep somebody detained or to torture them for such a long time. And I think that they realized this, but it was certainly a novelty in that I was being called often to interrogation just so that somebody could have the opportunity to speak English with a detainee, which was rare. I mean, there were other British detainees too. There were Australians and Canadians and so forth. But the other thing is that I never have been so anti-American that I wouldn't discuss issues with them or even try to assist them in understanding that we weren't all dedicated to the destruction of the American way of life, whatever that.
And, Mazam, when did you first find out that you might be going to Guantanamo?
Well, you know, I'd been threatened with that from the outset, that we can either talk here, and that was in Pakistan, or we can talk in Guantanamo. So the threat always loomed over my head. By the time that I'd spent almost 11 months, almost a year in U.S. custody in Afghanistan, Bagram and Kandahar included, I was actually looking forward to going to Guantanamo. That's how sick and that's how hopeless I had become. I knew of the existence of Guantanamo. I'd seen some of the pictures when I was still free in Pakistan of Guantanamo. And I could, that just demonstrates my the sort of the level of the mental state that I was in when I was in Bagram, because I believe Bagram and Kandahar were far worse than Guantanamo. And so that when I had this prospect of being, of knowingly being sent to spend possibly the next many years in an 8 by 8 foot by 6 foot cell, I was actually looking forward to it.
And it, and when you get to Guantanamo, I'm as shocked as I am about the physical conditions that you experience along the way. When you get to Guantanamo, they tease you with lawyers. They tease you with the idea that you might be able to find some legal out to this entire situation. And I found that most deploring, because it no one really knew what they were doing there as well.
Well, no, I mean, again, this is one of the problems that I have as a person, is that I always overestimate everybody. I always give people more credit than they do. And I think that this is what happened here. I assume that here you have the FBI, the CIA, and all sorts of alphabet organizations, which I think are you know, the most powerful, most intelligent, most articulate organizations in the world. So when I'm told by them that there's going to be a court proceeding and that I will get my chance in court and everything will be fine, I believe them. And at the same time, of course, I mean, they produced for me a confession for me to sign. Now, these guys had been involved already in severe torture, both psychological and physical, when I was held in Bagram. Insidiously, they turned up almost a day after I arrived in Guantanamo, asked the guard to leave the room, produced this confession, so-called typed-up piece of paper that they'd written in very bad English, and they had asked me to go through it and to sign it. My first reaction was that there's no way I'm going to sign anything without a lawyer, and of course their reaction was that you won't see a lawyer until then, unless you sign something like this, and you could be here for decades. In fact, you could get executed. We've seen the gas chambers, and they've just been built. So there are things like that that I couldn't believe that this is the FBI. These are, you know, those bastions of justice and law and order that are asking me to do this. But it demonstrated to me that the law, innocence, guilt, all of those things just did not apply.
I was also shocked that there were so many common faces at all of the places that you were imprisoned, that you encountered the same types of Americans, and in fact some of the same exact people in a lot of these places. And you mentioned a minute ago that you were not anti-American before. You know, what's your, after having spent 3 years with Americans like that, what's your impression of Americans now?
Well, of course, you know, I'm telling you one side of the story at this point, but the other side of the story is that I did come across many soldiers who were good, decent folk, which is what I imagined Americans to have been like. So the sort of image that I imagine Americans to be, these sort of jolly, happy-go-lucky type people who are just there doing their job, and, you know, fair enough, we're on the other side of the cage, but we can at least reciprocate our a respectable attitude of one another. And I came across several of those. I came, male, female, black, Hispanic, active duty, National Guard reservists, East Coasters and West Coasters, Bible bashers and atheists. All of them, I mean, I found plenty in common with a lot of them, and particularly, I think, in Guantanamo, because I was in isolation, solitary confinement for such a long time. That gave me almost a unique opportunity in some ways to be able to discuss things openly, candidly, and without fear of peer pressure on their part or my part in our conversation.
And many of them found commonalities with you. The conversations you have, especially surrounding your release, are quite surprising. And I also, you know, want to ask this. Americans, when they see Guantanamo on the news or when they hear about it on the news, you know, what do you hope Americans are thinking about? You know, what's the impression we should have of Guantanamo Bay?
Oh, that's just a difficult one. I mean, Guantanamo Bay is a place that should not exist. It should not exist because of the simple reason that although perhaps torture isn't taking place there now in the way that we understand it, what's taking place there is probably something worse, and that is illegal. It's limbo. It's being in an illegal limbo, a black hole of detention not knowing what you stand charged of, and not knowing if you'll ever be returned. Most of the people there are held there because their governments are not calling for their return, or because the United States government still simply says that it will not return these people. When Americans think of Guantanamo Bay, I think they should think of this is a contrary position to being the supporters and the bastions of freedom. Operation Enduring Freedom, ironically, was named such because it claimed that it was defending or trying to implement freedom. But in fact, all that it's done is incarcerated people in this part of the world arbitrarily, without charge, without trial, without meaningful communication with family members. And you wouldn't even treat the worst convicted criminals in the United States in this way.
Also, recently in the UK, you were consulted in the media regarding the suicides that have happened at Guantanamo. And you mentioned before about the mindset that you were in, about all the treatment. What do you think is behind the suicides at places like this?
First of all, on a personal level, I contend calling them suicides, and that's just because I've spoken to the family members of all of the people that had died, and none of them believe that it was a suicide. I've spoken to detainees who were released after the suicides, who were helped with these guys, and they say that they were taken to separate places. Now, doesn't mean that I'm accusing U.S. soldiers of committing blatant murder, although it did happen in Bagram. People did die from blows administered by U.S. soldiers. But I think probably something may have gone wrong, which they never intended. However, I think that when we're looking at the response from the United States government, from Colleen Graffy and people of her ilk, when she said that it was a public relations stunt, or when Rear Admiral Commander Harry Harris said that it's an act of asymmetric warfare, it just beggars belief that they can make these statements and say that, because Muslims around the world do suicide bombings, therefore these guys are using that sort of suicide mentality in order to cause a public relations stunt. It's rather extremely ludicrous. And it's very bad taste too. I think even the United States government official positions after that tried to distance themselves from these statements, but it caused a great amount of damage, I think.
So, is it possible for us to find a way out of it? You talk about Guantanamo as being a place that shouldn't exist. We're just this week, the international press is buzzing with the reality of the secret prisons being disclosed by the CIA. Is speaking about it helping? I mean, what's the reaction been from the locals there in the UK since your release?
I think speaking about it is helping. What people want to hear is that some of us detainees, or us detainees who were held there, have got some credence about our grievances about that place. Otherwise, I think people would say, well, we're quite happy for the place to exist. And the feeling, the mood here in this country, is that despite the terrible things that took place on September 11th, the United States, of course, has a right to defend itself in a legitimate means. It doesn't have the carte blanche to go around the world to capture people arbitrarily and to keep them and to kidnap them, because if that happened to its citizens, it wouldn't like it very much. And ironically, no U.S. citizen is ever taken to Guantanamo Bay to be held there, and that's despite the fact that U.S. citizens have been captured in the war on terror. So it's just a double standard. What needs to happen, in my opinion, is that there needs to be some sort of more open dialogue, sometimes between people who consider one another unpalatable, but the experience in this country, which has had a large experience, historical experience of terrorism with the IRA, in the end, what stopped the guns, what stopped the killing, what stopped the bombings was negotiations with parties that have once been considered allied to terrorism.
So having seen the solution work there in the UK, that solution is something that can grow across the world.
In my humble estimation, yes, and I think that what's important to recognize also is that you take an organization like Al-Qaeda, which is, we're told, either by design or otherwise, to an ignorant public, particularly perhaps in the United States of America, who are so distant physically from this part of the world. They're told that organizations like Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, are all the same. They're all part of this arc of extremism or so forth, when in fact you recognize that Al-Qaeda rejects democracy as a tool, as a method of dealing with people, whereas Hezbollah and Hamas are in fact for it and support it. So there are important things, important nuances that people need to understand that do not make everybody synonymous with terrorism. And to say that, to sort of reject the idea that people have a legitimate right to struggle as opposed to blatant wanton terrorism, again, is only going to produce us, put us in a more polarized position where there is no room for dialogue.
You're out there speaking a lot right now. What are young people asking you?
One of the biggest criticisms that I get from the younger people is that I'm too soft, too nice about my captors, that I'm not critical enough. But my response to them is that I have to be just. I have to be just to everybody. I will speak about the abuses in all the detail that I can, and at the same time, I will not exaggerate them, because exaggerating them would simply be wrong and simply be not truthful. So it's trying to strike a balance between both. And at the same time, I'm involved with all sorts of campaigns to highlight the plight of the detainees that are still left there, the campaign for their justice, and as a broader thing, to address some of the problems that are continuing and growing every single day in this country vis-a-vis the Muslim community and our standing with the rest of the community.
And what does the future bring for you after a life experience like this? One would imagine that you could conquer any mountain out there that you would face. What does the future bring for you, Mazam?
Well, you know, the future, if it was just that it ended at Guantanamo, after Guantanamo and my release, and I could get on with my life, that would be fine. But it's not. We're living in a world where things are happening on an almost daily basis, and it's difficult to know what the future will bring. If I was able to foreseeably, I would say that after this episode has gone, which I think is going to last for several years, I would be in the field of education and in the field of trying to help to build some bridges between people who want them built, not to force them upon people. So I think I have some capability in those spheres to be able to bring in the voice of reason, as long as there are people who want to listen to reason.
Mazam, it has been a true privilege to have you on the program here today. Thank you so much for joining us here today on Active Voice Radio.
Thank you.